Hello, everyone, and welcome to eLearning with E2R. This is October's installment. There will be one more in November. Mark your calendars. It's going to be scheduled for November the 28th on a topic yet to be disclosed to you. But today's topic is absenteeism in the workplace. It's something that does come up quite often in our practice, as I'm sure you are all well aware. But before Alexandra and I get started today, there are a few housekeeping reminders. Firstly, if you have any questions during the presentation, please feel free to use the chat box at the bottom right-hand side of your screen to type them out. We will try our best to get to them during the presentation if we can. If we can't, then we will be sure to reach back out to you to set up a call with an advisor to go through your question in detail. If you've missed any of our past webinars, you can find the recordings on our website at e2rsolutions.com, and all the PowerPoint presentations of our prior e-learnings can be found in your member portal. Lastly, we take this opportunity to remind you that the information contained in our webinars is an overview of the law only and is not intended to be an analysis of all areas of employment and labor law, and accordingly should not be relied upon as legal advice for any given situation. As always, if you have a specific matter about the webinar or anything else, please reach out to our team. We'll be sure to address those individually. Let's get started. So as I mentioned, we're dealing with absenteeism in the workplace. It's a very significant issue. I'm sure you've talked to us before about it. And so we have a great presentation today, and we're going to be going through a number of things. So at first, we're going to go through what is culpable absenteeism. So what's that idea? And then the opposite, what is non-culpable absenteeism and how best to deal with that? Then we're going to explain your obligations as it relates to the statutory leaves of absences under minimum employment standards legislation across the country. We will dive deep into medical leaves, and then following which we'll talk about frustration of contract, which relates directly to medical leaves. Then we're going to walk you through the practical aspects of disability management. We've outlined on the steps that should be followed in each particular case in pretty good detail. And we talk about some additional case law as relates to that as well. And then we're going to talk about like family status, which we also relates to absenteeism. And then we're going to kind of wrap things up with a nice bow on it. So let's get started.
Okay, so first, types of absenteeism. So first is culpable absenteeism. That's where the employee is to blame and the employee can control the behavior. So that's when the employee can't provide a reasonable justification for the absence. So they slept through their alarm or they didn't read the work schedule properly and didn't even know they were scheduled. Those would be examples. Non-culpable or innocent absenteeism means that the employee is not to blame. That would include things like statutory leaves of absences, illness or injury related, or it's related to child or elder care responsibilities. Now, culpable absenteeism, as an employer, it's your duty to figure out if it's culpable or non-culpable. You need to ask questions. You can't make assumptions. You need to ask the employee why they were late or why they were absent. If it is culpable, if it isn't related to a statutory leave or they're not sick or anything like that, then you can take the next step, which is progressive discipline. You want to give the employee an opportunity to correct the behavior before immediately resorting to termination. And the most common path is to follow the process of progressive discipline. So verbal warning, written warning, final written warning, maybe accompanied with a suspension, and then termination. You want to make sure you're tracking the absenteeism or tardiness, how late are they, how frequent are the absences, and you're identifying the reason given as to why they were late or absent. You should implement, if you don't have so already, an absenteeism and tardiness policy, clearly setting out the consequences up to and including termination for cause of being late or absent, and make sure that you're consistently and your managers are consistently enforcing this policy amongst all of your employees.
just before we move on to the next slide, I just want to make a quick note that in those policies, we shouldn't be having a one-size-all-fits approach. I know I've seen a number of policies over the years that speak to if there's three absences, then it's this warning. If it's five absences, then it's a termination. Each situation is going to be fluid, and so we shouldn't have any real hard or fast rules as to what kind of discipline will be triggered based upon a specific set number of absences. It's always best to seek specific advice kind of in advance of issuing, especially some kind of significant disciplinary penalty. So keep that in mind. So one of the non-culpable reasons for absenteeism might be something that someone can rely upon a statutory leave of absence for. And so, as many of you know, each province and in the federal jurisdiction, there is employment standards legislation. And in those pieces of legislation, there are various types of leaves of absences. Now, those leaves will vary from province to province and also at the federal level. There is some overlap, obviously, but the rules as it relates to who qualifies for the leave of absence, how long those absences are supposed to be for, all that sort of stuff is going to be individual to the province in which the employee is working. So you want to be mindful of that factor. And we've listed a number of absences or a number of types of statutory leaves below there. As you see, most commonly pregnancy and parental leave. There is personal emergency leave. That is particular, in this case, we're referencing the Ontario legislation. For our Ontario clients, as I'm sure you've been kind of made aware, there were some changes back at the beginning of the year as it relates to personal emergency leave under Bill 148. Well, there's a new bill that was issued yesterday, I believe, kind of Bill 47 by Doug Ford's Ontario government, which is going to make some significant changes if it's passed, which it will likely be passed, to those personal emergency leave days. Don't make any changes to your policies yet. We want to make sure that gets first, it actually passes, and then we want to be mindful of kind of removing certain things, and so we should walk through that whole process once it becomes official, but just keep that in mind. Then we have other examples. There's bereavement leave, domestic violence leave, and all the rest of them you can see on that list there. Again, always kind of check with us if you're not sure if an employee actually qualifies for a leave and what the requirements are around that. Some more information about leaves. Obviously, as a general rule, and there are exceptions to the rule, and we'll get to that momentarily, a statutory leave guarantees the employee's position or a comparable position upon their return if the original position does not exist. Typically, an employee cannot be subject to termination, discipline, or any adverse action, as an employer isn't permitted to discriminate against layoff or terminate an employee because they took a statutory leave of absence. Now, it's not supposed to give them added protection and them being the employee. It's not supposed to give them an extra kind of layer of protection in terms of kind of job security. They can be terminated for reasons that are unrelated to the leave. So for example, say they are in the marketing department and everyone in the marketing department is being terminated. That person doesn't get their job to be saved simply because they are on a leave or they have stated an intention to take the leave. It's just simply a reminder to employers that there are legitimate reasons why someone can be away from work for a set period of time without reprisal, but they are not saved from any other job action that would have otherwise been taken had they been there and working. Now, that's what the technical answer is, but optically, as you can appreciate, and often is the case, if someone is on a leave or has recently returned from a leave, we are going to want to be able to be in a position to prove that our job action is unrelated to that leave. There isn't supposed to be a reverse onus, but there will be if the employee alleges that they are being disciplined and or terminated for taking a leave. We want to be in a position to make sure that we can prove otherwise. Most leaves, as you know, are unpaid. There are some, again, there are some, depending upon the jurisdiction, there is a paid element to some of those leaves, but again, most leaves are unpaid. There is also the possibility that an employee may be entitled to multiple leaves for the same event. For example, if they have a sick family member, they may qualify for three different leaves in Ontario. So there would be the ability to rely upon the personal emergency leave. They would also be able to potentially rely upon the family, on the family caregiver leave, depending upon how sick that family member is. And then if the family member is really sick, there's another leave called family medical leave, which gives them an additional period of time off. And so it's possible that someone could qualify for multiple leaves and they aren't overlapping. So they aren't served kind of at the same time or concurrently. Someone can rely upon one leave and then take the next leave and take the next leave. It's not all lumped into one kind of period of time. So you want to be kind of very well aware of that as well.
One thing to just keep in mind with the leaves as well, some of the leave entitlements are based on the calendar year and some are based within a 52-week period. So there are some differences. So even though an employee has been granted a leave at one time, a few months later, if it's based on the calendar year, they could be eligible for the leave again. So just to keep that in mind as you're dealing with those types of requests. So now we're going to discuss medical leaves of absences. So an employee may exhaust all of the statutory leaves. So for example, in Ontario, an employee could exhaust all of a personal emergency leave for a medical reason and still be entitled to a further medical leave of absence. The federal and provincial human rights legislation protects employees against discrimination on the basis of the prohibited grounds, in this case, disability. And the basis of disability could be physical or mental, perceived or real.
Everyone's favorite a kind of concept, the duty to accommodate. It's a moving target. It's not necessarily as clear as we would like it to be. We're going to try to help explain it a little bit as it relates to absenteeism and medical leave, kind of more in particular. It does come into play as it relates to on the family status issue, which we will also get to. But as many of you know, an employer has a duty to accommodate a medical leave of absence or sporadic absences in certain cases, and is responsible for developing and implementing accommodations upon an employee's return to work up to the point of undue hardship, which we'll explain that in a minute. But accommodation is a two-way or perhaps three-way street if the employee is unionized, where everyone must actively participate and cooperate in the process. So the obligation simply isn't on the employer, although you're the one typically who has to drive the bus, and if you don't, you will be faulted for it. Employees do need to cooperate in that process, as does a union where the union is involved. What does cooperation mean? It means that they need to provide certain information to the employer to allow you to develop an accommodation plan. It also means perhaps that they accept not their kind of best form of accommodation. As long as your accommodation is reasonable, they need to be a bit more flexible as it relates to accepting that. Also, if an employee refuses to cooperate, then we can engage in progressive discipline. So oftentimes we will request medical on behalf of our clients to get a sense of when an employee is returning to work, what are their restrictions, all that lovely stuff. And employees tend to ignore those letters from time to time. When that does happen, we are permitted to institute progressive discipline, not for the leave of absence itself, but for the failure to cooperate in the accommodation process. And if there are enough letters that are ignored after issuing a final warning to that individual, then we may be able to move to a rightful termination for failure to cooperate, which we would probably call willful neglect of duties or willful misconduct. So the idea of undue hardship falls under the duty to accommodate, and that's kind of where your obligation stops. If we can prove undue hardship, then we don't need to accommodate a person's absenteeism or their medical circumstances. Now, this is a very, very difficult test to meet. And so an employer needs to be prepared to accept some hardships. It's not supposed to be easy, unfortunately. And so there is going to have to be some give and take, much like an employee must accept a non-perfect accommodation in certain circumstances. There are times when an employer is going to have to incur costs, incur scheduling difficulties, incur a whole bunch of uncomfortable things that fall short of undue hardship. And so there's a number of factors that our courts look to see whether or not undue hardship has been met. And the first one, which isn't generally accepted in most cases, is the financial cost. So that is going to be, that's going to carry less weight with a court. A court is going to want to see that the undue hardship from a financial perspective is almost going to put you in a place of bankruptcy. So that's a very high threshold to get to. If there is a cost associated with that accommodation, whether it's a standing desk or something that they're looking for that is going to be expensive, we are going to have to look at that, and we cannot use the excuse that it's too expensive to do it unless we reach that really high threshold. Also, what is going to matter is how big or small is your organization, right? A smaller organization isn't going to be required to do as much as a larger organization. A larger organization is able to adapt to someone who needs to start a bit later on a temporary or on a permanent basis. A larger organization will be able to move staff around to accommodate someone's ungraduated return to work program, whereas a smaller organization isn't able to absorb that kind of flexibility. So we're going to want to look at that factor. We're also going to look at how disruptive is the accommodation going to be to our operations. Are we not going to be able to do what we set out to do by virtue of the person's accommodation plan? We also need to look at any morale problems that the accommodation may have on other employees. Oftentimes, our clients will indicate, and rightfully so, that if we give this person accommodation, everyone is going to ask for it. Well, that is called the floodgate argument, and it has been rejected kind of over and over again by our courts and our tribunals. We can't assume that an accommodation is going to constitute an undue hardship in the future because everyone's going to ask for it. If it happens, it happens, but we can't kind of rely upon the idea that other people will ask for the same accommodation. We also want to look and see if there's any substantial interference with the rights of other individuals or groups. In particular, under a collective agreement, we need to understand whether or not our accommodation plan is going to infringe on someone else's rights under the collective agreement. So we want to be aware of all of those issues. The next kind of factor, the interchangeability of the workforce and the facilities, again, that's going to relate to the larger employer issue. If you're a larger employer, they're going to expect you to be more flexible in terms of accommodation plans. And the last consideration is the health and safety concerns of the employee and the other employees, quite frankly, and even if you deal with kind of on the public, are there any safety concerns related to them by virtue of your accommodation plan? I do want to note quickly that the health and safety of the individual may be waived to a certain point under an accommodation plan, whereas the health and safety of other employees and your actual customers or clients will be more paramount. So, for example, if an accommodation may put that employee's kind of health and safety in jeopardy a little bit, we may have to allow that person to accept that risk as part of the accommodation plan, but we don't need to accept any risk to our other employees.
Okay, so now we're going to chat about the common law doctrine of frustration of contract, which basically means an employment contract is discharged where the parties have not contemplated the circumstances that arise and performance of the contractual obligations becomes impossible through no fault of either party. So it's important to note that this is not simply about passage of time. Just because an employee's been off work for 2 years doesn't mean automatically the relationship is frustrated. Courts have repeatedly held that there's no specific timeline that triggers frustration, no magic number. An employer may be able to justify the dismissal of an employee where an employee's medical prognosis indicates that the employee will be unable to perform the essential duties of his or her job in the foreseeable future. In this case, the contract is frustrated and the employer can treat the employment agreement as having come to an end. Keep in mind, though, that depending on the jurisdiction, you may still be required to provide notice of termination, which has to be paid in lieu of notice of termination because you can't provide working notice if an employee is on a medical leave, and statutory severance pay if you're in Ontario or you're federally regulated, where a frustration of contract occurs due to illness or injury. So even though you're terminating on the basis of frustration, it can still be costly, particularly where the employee has a lot of service. So for example, in Ontario, if you have an employee that's been there for 20 years and we're terminating on the basis of frustration, you're looking at paying out 28 weeks. So it can still be costly, but obviously it's usually a win when we finally get to frustration of contract. Now I'm going to speak briefly about the practical aspects of disability management. So first we're going to chat about seeking medical documentation, what the process is, what you can ask for, what you can't ask for. We're going to talk about accommodation and how to devise an accommodation plan upon reviewing the medical information that's been provided. Step three, we're going to chat about the importance of communication with the employee. Step four, document, document, document. That's pretty self-explanatory. And step five, stop. We're going to chat about waiting before you prematurely discipline or consider terminating an employee on a medical leave.
So obviously the first step is generally going to start with a request for medical documentation, either by virtue of the fact that the employee has indicated that they're unable to work for medical reasons and they simply stop showing up. It also may arise where an employee has absenteeism issues and we want to understand if there's an underlying medical condition as it relates to those absences to determine if we can accommodate or not. It also may arise where someone comes in and says, I hurt myself, I need certain accommodations in the workplace. Not even related to a leave, but just certain accommodations as they carry out their day-to-day work. Now, we want to insist on medical documentation. We don't want to simply grant leaves of absences without it because then we're not necessarily going to be able to meet our duty to accommodate. And one thing we're not going to want to accept is the employee's word as it relates to being unable to work or unable to do certain things. We're not interested in the employee's subjective restrictions. We want to know what the doctor says are the restrictions, whether it's a wholly inability to work or some other kind of restrictions that must be present in the workplace. But we want that information from a doctor. Now, sometimes we'll get a medical note from a physiotherapist, in which case we generally will recommend that we kind of push back on the employee and ask for a doctor's note. That's typically for liability reasons. We want to make sure that we're getting the information from a medical practitioner that is actually qualified to make that kind of judgment call. We're always going to be balancing the interests of the employee's privacy and our need to verify the person's disability, their prognosis for returning to work, and what the restrictions are. And so we're looking for a prognosis, not a diagnosis. And we'll delve on the next slide into what we are allowed to ask for and what we're not allowed to ask for. We've also outlined a very important distinction there, which is insurance information versus medical information. So there are many times where the company's insurance company will come to a conclusion that is different than the employee's treating physician. So, for example, your long-term disability insurer has said the person is able to work. They are not totally disabled under the terms of the policy. And that's great for the insurance purposes, but that doesn't necessarily mean that we are absolved from any obligations to that employee or that we can force that employee to return to work. The insurance company is not the gospel for our employer obligation. And so there are a number of cases where employers have relied upon the insurance company's medical information or medical conclusion that says the employee can work, or cannot work, and the employer has relied upon that information to take certain action, and the court has said, no, employer, you need your own information from the employee. And you can appreciate the insurance company's objectives or incentives are different. Oftentimes, they want to get that person off of disability benefits, and so they will kind of push for a return to work program that may even be contrary to the employee's own doctor. So we need to be getting information from a doctor, because there can be situations where an employee does not qualify for long-term disability benefits but is still unable to work, and our duty to accommodate does not stop at that point. As it relates to what we can and are not able to ask for, we're not entitled to a medical diagnosis. So we're not entitled to know what is wrong with the employee. We're not like, do they have cancer? Do they have this? Do they have that? We're not entitled to their diagnosis. We're not entitled to their lab results or their test results, x-rays, the names of the medications that they are on. We are only entitled to the nature of the illness. That does not include the diagnosis, but necessarily kind of whether the illness is permanent or temporary, what are the limitations or restrictions as it relates to that employee's job duties and how it interplays with the person's medical diagnosis, but not the diagnosis itself. We're allowed to know whether the issues are likely to be resolved in the future, or that's the near future or the long-term future, and what the approximate kind of time frame for all of that is. We are entitled to know whether there is a medication in play that may impact the employee's ability to safely or kind of productively meet their obligations to you as the employer. So for example, medical marijuana is in the news a lot now. If someone is on medical marijuana, we are going to be able to ask a doctor whether or not their medications are impacting their position. Now, marijuana is a unique situation whereby we may be able to ask the employee what medication they are on, because if they are smoking marijuana on their breaks, for example, which is now legal in terms of being able to kind of recreationally use marijuana, we need to know whether or not that employee is using marijuana for medical purposes, because if they are not, then they are not permitted to smoke marijuana on their breaks. That would be not allowed, even though it's legal to smoke marijuana, much like an employee is not able to go out at lunchtime and kind of put back a few beers and come back to work. Just because it's legal doesn't mean they have a right to do that. So in that particular case, we may be able to understand what the actual kind of prescription is and then find out whether or not we can accommodate that prescription use based upon whether it impacts their ability to do their job safely and effectively. And lastly, we want an opinion as it relates to whether an accommodation is medically necessary. Sometimes we get the request for the standing desk or what have you, and that standing desk might cost us $6,000. They want a really nice, expensive standing desk. Well, we are permitted to go back to a doctor and ask the doctor if there are any less expensive means that we are able to implement that will meet the same end. For example, if we allow the employee to stand and walk around every couple hours, will that get us to the same position? And so we are able to kind of question certain accommodation requests as it relates to that. And lastly, and perhaps very importantly, is if the medical information is not clear, we are absolutely within our right to go back to, and we always do, go back to a doctor and say, we don't understand this, we can't read what you're saying, quite frankly, or those types of things. We need you to expand upon this accommodation. So we can always ask for clarification as it relates to what is the restriction, what's the prognosis, is it temporary, is it permanent, all that sort of stuff. We need as much information we need in order to meet our obligations, essentially.
Okay, step two, accommodation. So this is when you're engaging in the actual exercise of assessing whether it's possible to accommodate the disability or leave of absence, et cetera. So make sure you're documenting all your efforts in this regard, and more on that in step three. Remember that each situation has to be considered individually. There's not a one-size-fits-all approach. What worked for another employee that had a back problem doesn't necessarily work for this employee that has a back problem. Keep that in mind. Determine what the essential duties of the employee's job is. If there's a job description, that's usually a pretty awesome place to start. Determine, based on the medical provided, the employee's abilities to return to work and perform the essential duties of the job with accommodation measures. Consider modifying the duties, the work procedures, hours of work, and physical aspects of the job, even if it's inconvenient and even if there is a cost incurred. Just because it's annoying or it's going to amount to some cost doesn't mean that we get to say no automatically. Remember, the test is to undo hardship. If the employee cannot return to work and because original duties cannot be performed with accommodation, consider other positions. Is there some admin work that could be done? Perhaps it's not 40 hours a week and the employee was previously working 40 hours a week. Maybe we have some work that can be done in a back office that's 20 hours a week. Great, offer that. The employee is entitled to a reasonable accommodation, not a perfect accommodation. They don't get to dictate exactly what they want. We should be flexible, creative, and innovative in our approach. And the employee must facilitate, cooperate, and accept reasonable, but not necessarily perfect accommodation. Except that sometimes the accommodation is a continued unpaid leave of absence. Sometimes it can be lengthy, and it may not amount to undue hardship. We've seen leaves of absences that have gone on for 2 years where the doctor kind of keeps on saying they can return to work in 3 months, they can return to work in 3 months. And so long as the doctor is continuing to say that they can return to work in the foreseeable future, you aren't going to be able to terminate on the basis of frustration. Do not forget the administrative side of time away from work. Offer the employee any sick time or vacation time that may be available to the employee. Administer the company's group benefit plan. If the premiums are 50-50 split between the employer and employee, we can still ask the employee to continue to pay their portion of the benefits. So we typically would just ask them to pay or provide post-dated checks. Remember to issue the record of employment so the employee can apply for EI, and the code is D when the employee is off for illness or disability.
So step three in the process, and this is kind of, it's ongoing, is going to be the communication with the employee. So we are always going to want to be in contact directly with the employee and their treating physician through the employee. And so we don't want to, again, be relying upon any communications with the LTD insurer. That's a process that is separate and apart from our obligations to accommodate under human rights. We don't want them just to simply run with the file and us jump in at some point and not know what's going on. We want to be in direct communication with the employee. And we're going to be asking for updated information as things go on. You are allowed to ask what is going on. So, for example, say we get a medical note that says they're off for the next month. Well, we are going to probably want to ask kind of near the end of that month for updated medical information. We're going to want to make sure that they can either return to work safely or know whether or not the leave should be extended. That stuff is going to allow us to manage the workforce, so we'll know whether or not we need to keep someone in a position that is kind of temporarily replacing someone on leave, and just helps everyone involved know what's going on by communicating. Now, we want to be what we call here elegantly assertive, but not harassing. So we can be forceful in our requests in terms of setting certain deadlines for responding to our requests. We can remind employees that they are obligated to provide us with certain medical information, which we typically do in all of our letters. We kind of remind them of their obligation in this accommodation process, but we don't want to be overly kind of harassing employees. So, for example, if we get a medical note that says so-and-so is off for 3 months, it's probably not the wisest decision to give a letter kind of a couple weeks into that asking for updated medical information. If the initial medical information isn't clear, absolutely fine. We can seek information that early in the stage. We don't want to issue letter after letter after letter if they've already been cleared from working for 3 months. So we don't want to be harassing, but we want to be assertive. We also don't want to ignore our employees on medical leave. You wouldn't be surprised to know that there are a number of times when we talk to a client and they say so-and-so has been medical leave since 2016. I don't know what's going on. Let's find out what's going on. Well, like, we should never have gotten to that point. We should have been in communication with them throughout, because we may have been able to move them off our payroll depending upon what their medical issue is. We also want to make sure that we're not going over and above and paying for their benefits for an extended period of time if we don't have to. There might be times when we do have to, but we want to make sure that we're monitoring the process as it goes along. And one thing we do need to always keep in mind is that that employee is still an employee of ours unless they've resigned in writing or they're being kind of terminated by us for reasons unrelated to the leave, unless we do have frustration of contract. So that employee is still your employee. It's still your obligation. And quite frankly, that service time is just increasing the actual liability at the end of the day if we do need to terminate them for reasons unrelated to that leave. Step four, as Alexandra said, it's pretty self-explanatory. Document, document, document. We're going to want to record all of our steps that we've taken to accommodate the employee. And so we're going to want to record any actual accommodation plans that we've implemented and the cost of implementing them. And in fact, under certain pieces of legislation, for example, in Ontario, there is AODA, which requires us to have formal accommodation plans in place that needs to be in writing. And we want to have that on record. And we definitely want to have it on record because if anyone ever alleges down the road that we failed to accommodate someone, we want to have a copy of all those records and all those accommodation plans to say, no, wait a minute, we have tried to get in touch with this employee and they're not responsive. Or wait a minute, we have the medical prognosis that says it's frustration of contract. We want that evidence to be able to have to defend ourselves potentially if things go sideways in the future. Also on that point, in any follow-up letters, we're going to want to document our previous efforts. So for example, say we've issued already two medical requests and we haven't gotten anything back. In that very document, we're going to want to record and outline to the employee that we have in fact attempted to reach them by letter. We've attempted to reach them by phone. We left voicemail messages that are unreturned. All that sort of stuff, because we want to be able to show some third party, if necessary, that we have gone above and beyond our obligations to try to get information from that particular employee. And still more me, we got step five. Step five is stop. This is when we need to know when it is appropriate for us to stop this process. So it's not impossible to discipline or terminate an employee that is on a medical leave or that is working with restrictions. It is a separate topic unto itself, and it could be a whole e-learning. We may do it in the future, so stay tuned. But just some brief things to keep in mind. There are a number of optics that are going to be in play when we are terminating someone who is on a leave or just returning from a leave. As I mentioned earlier, there isn't supposed to be an added protection of their job, but we are likely going to have to prove why that person is being terminated, and that reason generally has to be unrelated to their medical circumstances. And just quickly on that point, that idea of unrelatedness, that scope is very wide. So for example, oftentimes someone goes on medical leave for an extended period of time, 6, maybe 12 months. And while they're away, we discover that A, they weren't very good at their job, perhaps. B, that their replacement is a superstar. Or C, by divvying up their duties, we've discovered that it's just more efficient not to have that role. Those types of reasons are related to the medical leave. And that would be a claim, a successful claim of discrimination, if we argued that the employee is being terminated because their job duties have been split up and all that sort of stuff. So we need to be very mindful of what relatedness means. And so keep that in mind as well, because if a tribunal does find that the disability was a contributing factor, even if it's 1% of our decision-making process, there can be a finding of discrimination. And that goes back again to the document piece. We want to be able to prove our accommodation efforts, and also, as relates to that, prove if their termination is unrelated wholly to their medical leave of absence. You can also discipline employees that have been accommodated, but we need to be very, very careful in doing that. We need to stop, for example, if someone is working under modified duties, we need to stop and see whether or not their performance issues may be related to their medical condition, because then that would be non-culpable kind of performance issues, and we might need to explore more with the treating physician as relates to whether or not they're able to do those essential functions, not simply rushing to discipline them for performance, because that could also be a breach of the human rights codes or the acts in various jurisdictions. We definitely can discipline for a failure to cooperate, as we've outlined earlier. If someone is not cooperating in the accommodation process, we may be able to get to a point where we can terminate for job abandonment or willful neglect of duty. So always keep that in mind. And when there's a permanent disability that requires a leave where the employee will have been able to return for the foreseeable future, which we've talked about before, we may be able to argue that the contract has become frustrated at law, meaning through no fault of either the employee or the employer, the relationship as originally intended just cannot go on because of the medical circumstances. That will not be discrimination, but we do need that very clear prognosis from the doctor. It's not an assumption simply based upon the passage of time. It is going to be a medical prognosis that we're going to be looking for to make that argument.
Okay, so now for the fun stuff, some cases. So this first case is Wilson versus Solus Mexican Food, Inc. It's an Ontario Superior Court of Court decision from 2013. So the employee was a business analyst that made about $65K a year, and they went on a medical leave for an issue with their back. Now, the doctor proposed a gradual return to work, but the company refused, advising that it would only return the employee if the employee was capable of returning to full-time hours and full duties. So just for your reference, the proposed gradual return to work was that the employee would be part-time hours for 2 weeks and then would return to full-time hours. And the only other kind of modified duties was going to be that the employee had to, like, stand up and walk around when their back was uncomfortable. So not a crazy accommodation plan proposed by the doctor. The company was sold and the employee's employment was terminated. She was given 2 weeks of notice. At the time of termination, the employee had 15 months of service. And the employee made a claim for wrongful dismissal as well as a claim for damages under the Human Rights Code, alleging that the termination had to do with the leave. Now, in terms of the decision, the evidence at trial suggested that the termination was related, at least in part. It only has to be in part, just a factor, to the employee's disability. The court did not find the company's argument that the employee was terminated due to the sale persuasive or credible. The employee was awarded $20,000 in compensation for discriminatory treatment, which is pretty big considering that that exceeded the wrongful dismissal damages, which was only $16,250. That was basically what 3 months of pay amounted to, and legal costs. So in terms of lessons learned from this case, we learned that temporary illnesses, such as a back ailment, can qualify as a disability under the human rights legislation, and that employers typically cannot insist upon full fitness before allowing an employee to return to work.
The next case that we'll talk about quickly is the Campbell versus the Rivera Retirement LP. It's an Ontario decision as well. But again, even though these cases are coming from Ontario, they are generally applicable from a principal perspective all throughout the country, so keep that in mind. So the facts in this case are as follows. The employee went on a medical leave for a disability, a physical disability in this case. They were also then cleared to return to work, but they required specific accommodations. Those accommodations were not compatible with returning her to her former position of a healthcare aide. The company then conducted an analysis of all the available positions within the company and documented why a position was or was not appropriate, which is good so far. As a result of that analysis, the company determined that the employee could work in the company's laundry facility with accommodation. So they looked at available and suitable work. They found this role. They had determined that she could do this role with accommodations. They notified the employee of this, and the employee disagreed. The employee provided the company then with a note that said she could not fulfill the laundry position. Maybe she didn't want the position. Who knows? Doesn't matter at this point because she had a medical note that said she could not do it. The company believed that the employee's concerns with the position were addressed by the modification, so the company disagreed with the employee's medical, and they subsequently ended the relationship. They then ended the relationship, and sure enough, the employee made a claim saying that the company discriminated against. They failed to accommodate her medical circumstances. So the tribunal looked and it said the company took all steps possible to place the employee in a job, which was the correct thing to do. They looked at available and reasonable employment. However, as opposed to terminating her at that point, once they received the medical note, the company should have provided the employee with a continued leave of absence until there was a change in her restriction. So as we mentioned earlier, sometimes the form of accommodation may be a further medical leave of absence, especially if there is a prognosis that those restrictions will get better in the future, allowing her to return to work. And the company should not have, in this case, insisted that the employee take a job, especially given that she had medical information that said she could not do the job. And so if the company was not satisfied with the medical documentation, according to the tribunal and their obligations, they should have gone back and sought some further clarification from the doctor, or even maybe in this case suggested the use of an independent medical examination. The remedies in this case were small. She was only awarded $5,000 in compensation for the discrimination. On that point, I would note that if this case was now, that award would be much, much larger. The awards keep getting larger year over year over year, and I would not be surprised if she was awarded somewhere in the neighborhood of $25,000 to $30,000 in general damages. This case was unique because she was in a unionized kind of position, so they did not award her any lost wages or any reinstatement. That was dealt with through an ancillary kind of union grievance that was resolved on different terms, so that's why the tribunal did not award damages in that respect. What are the lessons? Well, the lessons are very clear. We need to carefully assess an employee's restrictions when reviewing available and suitable work. In this case, if our proposed accommodation is objected to by the employee on medical grounds, so that would be very clear, not simply, I don't like to work in the laundry, that's not sufficient. If there's medical information saying they can't do the accommodated job, then we need to make sure we're reviewing what their restrictions are. If we are ever in doubt as it relates to what the restrictions are, we need to seek some additional clarification, maybe ask the doctor if there are any other accommodations we can make in that role to make it work for everyone involved. And jumping to a termination isn't the most appropriate step. And lastly, sometimes the appropriate accommodation is just a further medical leave of absence. And so we always got to keep that in mind that might be the most appropriate method of accommodation.
Okay, we're moving on to kind of the last leg of our presentation. We're going to chat about family status, which is like a disability, also a protected ground underneath the provincial and federal human rights legislation. And it's particularly relevant in absenteeism because often employees are absent for a reason that could be connected to either their child care responsibilities or elder care responsibilities. Family status is defined differently in the different jurisdictions. In Ontario, the Human Rights Code defines family status as the status of being in a parent and child relationship. In Alberta, it's the status of being related to another person by blood, marriage, or adoption. In Quebec doesn't specifically prohibit discrimination on the basis of family status, but it has a protected ground called civil status, which has been held consistently to include family status. And while family status isn't defined in British Columbia, the term has been interpreted as one status as parent or child among other relationships. So when an employee raises a family status issue, proceed with caution. The concept of family status has evolved over the past few years and now requires employers to accommodate employees when their family obligations conflict with the workplace requirement, qualification, or practice. So that we need to consider that when an employee is absent, is it related to childcare or elder care? For example, are they caring for a sick spouse, partner, parent, or child? Did daycare arrangement fall through? Are they absent because they're helping an aging parent make the transition into assisted living? It wouldn't include a family vacation. It wouldn't include being absent for a soccer game or I don't know, a piano recital. You might be laughing, but those are questions that we get sometimes. So that isn't protected, but the other examples listed on the slide are. Similar to disability management, the employers have a duty to accommodate family status obligations to the point of undue hardship. So I'm going to briefly go over the accommodation process. And again, similar to medical file management, you're going to want to document everything. If you need to create a like separate standalone file where you're writing down all your efforts, great. I love that. If there's ever a human rights complaint, that's going to come in super handy. So ensure you have a clear understanding of the employee's child care or elder care needs. Now, I know these conversations can seem awkward, especially if there's a sensitive situation or the employee gets emotional, but you have to ask questions. You need to understand what their need stems from. Be polite, be respectful, but ask. You're allowed to ask, and quite frankly, you need to ask. Discuss with the employee whether alternative care arrangements have been explored. That might include asking if there's another family member available that can assist with the child care or elder care. Provide referrals to programs through any employee assistance program or otherwise assist the employee with his or her search for services. You can provide direct assistance to the employee to search for services in his or her local area. You can explore whether other employees are prepared to cooperate to facilitate the accommodation. Remember that the duty to accommodate also involves other employees kind of stepping up and kind of sharing that burden. Consider possible accommodations such as a leave of absence, modified hours of work, working remotely, et cetera.
And so we have a case here. It's a seminal case in this area. I mean, it's the Johnstone case, and it's essentially what the test is going to be, and it has kind of developed a bit further since this decision was issued, but this is what it kind of boils down to determine whether or not there is discrimination resulting from a child care obligation. So first we need to determine whether a child is under the employee's care. Second kind of aspect of the test is, does the child care obligation engage the individual's legal responsibility? So is it a choice or is it not a choice? So for example, having to look after your child isn't necessarily a choice, whereas going to their kind of recital would be a choice. It's not a legal obligation to go to your kid's recital, although your little daughter might think it is. We also want to make sure that the employee has made efforts to meet those obligations through alternative means. So we call that self-accommodation. Now, self-accommodation is an interesting thing. There has been an Ontario decision recently that indicates that an employee doesn't necessarily have to self-accommodate before the duty to accommodate is triggered. So self-accommodation might not always be required, but we're always going to want to be able to push back on the employee and ask them if they have self-accommodated. We want to raise that as a possibility because maybe they just haven't looked at it. So we want to make sure that that is in play. And we also, in order to meet the test, there has to be a workplace rule that is going to interfere with that family accommodation that is more than trivial. And if there is the option potentially to argue that the rule that is causing them an issue is a bona fide occupational requirement, meaning it's a job requirement that we can't actually make a change because it's really fundamental to that rule, and that's going to vary from role to role. So just always keep that in mind. And so not consistent, as I've mentioned, but it is the leading case in this area. But cases have been getting more and more employee friendly. And unfortunately, this is an area of the law that is ever evolving. We've been saying that for years, and it continues to evolve. And so we just need to be mindful of all of that. I actually recently kind of read a case. It was actually yesterday where an employee did not provide the employer with enough information, and the employer was successful in arguing that the employee kind of failed to meet their obligations under the duty to accommodate because they didn't give enough information for the employer to determine whether accommodation was possible or not. So again, it is a two-way street in family status as it is in disability management. Keep that in mind, and Alexander is going to go through our last case, and then we'll wrap things up for you.
Okay, so this is Devaney versus ZRV Holdings Limited. So the employee was an architect who was frequently absent from work over a significant period of time in order to care for an elderly mother. The employer insisted that the employee, who is the lead of a major firm project, regularly attend the office between the hours of 8:30 and 5. Now, the employee argued that he was working more than enough hours just often from home. He was still working, I think, overtime for like 400 hours in that year, and that he asserted that he never missed any important clients or internal meetings, but just because he had to care for his mother, he had to work remotely from time to time. The employee was ultimately terminated for cause as a result of failing to meet the expectation of regular attendance in the actual office. The employee had 27 years of service. Upon termination, the employee was provided with 34 weeks and found new employment in 4 or 5 weeks after the termination, but the employee made a claim to the Human Rights Tribunal for discrimination on the basis of family status. So in terms of the tribunal decision, the tribunal concluded that the high proportion of his absences, or at least his absence from the office, were related to providing for his ailing mother. The tribunal applied a different test from Johnstone. The applicant must establish that the respondent's attendance requirements had an adverse impact on the applicant because of absences that were required as a result of the applicant's responsibilities as his mother's primary caregiver. The applicant argued that his responsibilities weren't a matter of choice or preference, and that he was required and was the primary caregiver to his ailing mother. He also argued that he wasn't asking to work remotely for a permanent or even the majority of the time. In fact, about a few weeks prior to his termination, he had just landed his mother in a long-term care facility. So realistically, this wouldn't have been as big of an issue moving forward. In conclusion, the tribunal ruled that the employer's strict office attendance requirements resulted in discrimination on the basis of family status. The tribunal also ruled that the employer failed to demonstrate that its strict office attendance requirements were reasonably necessary and it failed in its duty to reasonably accommodate his personal circumstances. The employer had an obligation to inquire more into his caregiver responsibilities and explore what could be done to accommodate them, which the tribunal held was not done by the employer. So in terms of the damages, he was awarded $15,000 in general damages, and the employer was ordered to develop a workplace human rights and accommodation policy and provide mandatory human resource accommodation training to all members of the firm who had any kind of supervisory or human resource function.
So I guess as evidenced by this one-hour presentation that probably could have been at least 3 hours, managing employee absenteeism in the workplace is not a simple task. And so we're always going to want to find out why was the employee absent before we proceed with progressive discipline. That's the first step. Is it culpable? Then great, we can proceed with progressive discipline. If it's non-culpable, we're going to want to see, is it related to a statutory leave of absence? Is it a disability? Is it related to family status? And if it is, then we're going to want to proceed with caution because it's going to trigger either an obligation to grant the leave under legislation or our obligation to accommodate up to that very high point of undue hardship. And all these principles do also clearly demonstrate that it is a two-way street. The employee must comply with the employer's reasonable request for information and documentation. We need to work together to see how best we can, if we are able to accommodate And where the employee does not cooperate, then we are free to take disciplinary steps against the employee. These things are complicated, so please do not ever hesitate to reach out with any questions, any help managing your medical files or your family status requests. We will walk you through the process. We will help you through them. We will advise you what your obligations are. I want to thank you again for joining us today. Our next presentation is, again, November 28th. We will update you as always to what that topic is in the coming weeks. So on behalf of myself, Alexandra, I want to thank you again, and we'll be talking to you soon.